We're going to continue today talking about Axon guidance pathways and how they're going to contribute to wiring up the nervous system to allow us to have all these amazing abilities that we take for granted. This is one of my favorite images in neuroscience. It's a movie, obviously. It's a bunch of neurons in culture that happen to be hippocampal neurons, but it doesn't really matter much. These are the inhibitory neurons in the brain. What I like about this movie is it gives you a little bit better sense than is typical, sort of artist pictures, of two things. One is how many neurons there are in the brain. This is, of course, just a tiny handful. But usually we see images of just one. The person trying to make some one little point. And if they were to create a busy slide with 50 things happening, you'd miss something. And so they always make these images that are really, really easy and simple for you to stare at and go, I see the one thing I'm supposed to see, the wiggling growth cone or the expression pattern of the gene or whatever it is. I like this movie because there is so much happening. You really get the sense that there's a little community of animals running around doing things. These cells are primary culture neurons, so they're really the simplest kind of neurons. You can see they've each got one or maximum two or three processes, and so we're still really great at simplifying. Imagine this picture with just these, whatever it is, 100, 150 neurons. If each of them were making 10,000 connections or even 10 connections, it'd be mind-boggling to try to watch the thing. So this is much more complex than we're used to seeing, but it's still a greatly simplified preparation compared to what we're really interested in. I've got lots of favorite neurons in this movie because I've watched it so many times, so I'll point them out to you. Let's watch these two neurons here in this little dance that they're doing. What you'll see is to back it up in time. The two neurons are moving toward each other. Let's just ignore that for the moment. But let's watch their processes. Here's one of them. This one's got two processes. One going off that one, one off this way. And as we move forward in time, what you see is, not only do the cells move toward each other, but they look like they might be forming a synapse. If you watch them for a little bit, though, you see that it goes and retracts that connection. So this is all going forward in time, except it's now retracting it. I'm marching forward this way. It sent out that process and then took it back. And if you watch a little bit more in time, it goes, oh, I do want to shake your hand, okay? So watch it in real time, or sort of pseudo real time. You'll see it's going back and forth, trying to decide, should I make contact with this guy? Right, so extend the process out there multiple times. You can look around here, the same sort of thing happens over and over and over. You can follow another cell. Again, a cell migrating. Here, I just watch this growth cone growing further and further and further afield. Again, because the cells are not in culture, the cell body itself is moving. It's actually being drug along behind by its growth cone, which is not the way things normally work. Normally, there'd be a bunch of tissue that would anchor you in place, and so if the growth cone is pulling, you wouldn't normally pull the whole body along. But it's interesting, in watching these things look like guys taking their dogs for a walk, but the dog is not very well behaved. This thing has so much power as to be able to pull this much larger cell body. And again, the great distance that this thing travels is interesting, but the more interesting part is that it's in such a straight line, and it just seems so purposeful. It looks like it knows where it's going. And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. We're going to talk about that. This is an odd situation because there aren't all the normal cues. We've ripped everything out and plopped all the cells down. So they're just doing the best that they can, but they're presumably implementing the same rules that they would be implementing if they were in the brain.
What's the grid in the back?
The grid is just the bottom of a cell culture plate that allows you to, when you want to go through counting things.
That doesn't affect the...
It has nothing to do with anything. It's just those are etched into the bottom of the plastic. It's not even on the top layer. So it's other questions about this movie? Okay, so we'll watch it one more time. What we want to be thinking about is, you know, why is that cell sending this out? Why are these other cells connecting and disconnecting and reconnecting? What is it that they're doing? And obviously, in this case, they're not doing calculus, they're not remembering the location of things, they're not remembering phone numbers, they're not doing anything. They're just neurons doing about their business. But from the point of view of neurons in your head, they don't know that they're remembering phone numbers. They don't know that they are remembering your grandmother or contributing to your tennis serve or remembering your neuroscience lesson. They have no idea. So 1/100 billionth of you, your individual neurons, don't know what they're doing. And this is an important perspective. I sometimes go too far with this and kind of creeps people out, like imagining these billions of little things inside your head, no one of which knows what it's doing. But I think it's very worthwhile to think about the world from the point of view of one of your neurons. It's dark inside there. There's no vision. There's no hearing. You're just groping around in the dark trying to figure out what circuit to form. You're not just trying to find one partner, but 10,000 partners. And we have very little understanding about how the genome, with only 35,000 genes, could possibly be contributing to this. The answer is going to be very much like we saw in the Notch Delta, that you're going to need a handful of genes. Maybe it's 100, maybe it's even 1,000. But it's not a billion. A handful of genes are going to be able to set up billions and billions and billions and billions of synapses in a very organized fashion that's going to contribute to the formation of a circuit. And it isn't going to matter that much whether that circuit is computing your name or your memories or your skills or your emotions or anything else. Okay. More quick movies for fun. This is just to get us back to the single cell level. Again, what we're seeing is, backwards in time, this fiber sending out a process, take it step by step, and eventually finding some target. Because we're zoomed in, what you can see is it actually eventually succeeds in forming a real synapse. Okay. So there's a whole bunch more than just wandering around. That's one thing. But the same structure that's got to be able to move, has to be able to smell, it also has to turn into a synaptic release site. And then has to be able to unplug itself, wander around in some other conditions, and rehook itself up. So that's three broad jobs you need to think about one of these ends being able to do. One is to do exocytosis. It's going to be a presynaptic nerve terminal. But also to do movement and also to sense the environment so that it knows how to move. It's not going to get its instructions from someone else. It's going to figure out where it needs to go all by itself. And the last one is most carefully controlled. It's again going to be just a single cell. Again, there's going to be some gush in the slide. All this is just yuck. This is more yuck. This is more yuck. So don't get into the yuck. This is a border, though. This is a neuron growing out of this cluster of cells that sent this process down here. Maybe it was first tracked there and eventually left a branch there. But it's wandering around trying to find some target. You can see all these long processes out here, all part of this growth cone. And it's eventually going to encounter some transition. And it's going to be the transition between two substances, both of whom neurons can grow from the bottom of glass with. You can cover your glass in polyglycine or laminin, either one, and neurons can stick to that just fine. It's not impossible to grow on, but it's going to prefer one of these two substrates over the other. And you see all, again, sending out these processes, these filipodia, these lamellipodia, sort of sitting there, what's this to do? And eventually, it manages to pull a turn out of this. Now, and the most elegant turn, right? When you go turn your car, you just turn it, and it goes, and you don't sit there sort of swirling around in place trying to decide what you're going to do. But that's what you see the neurons are doing. They're really struggling here. It doesn't seem like it has any idea what it's doing. It's sending out processes that are ranging, and they're flashing, but they're ranging from way over here to way over here. And the analogy I would give is much more like a dog trying to smell the trail of a rabbit that went by some hours ago, not really sure what it's doing. But eventually, typically by trying lots of things, it eventually gets to the right place where the rabbit is usually hiding. Okay. So this is somewhat intermediate between two very extreme models of axon guidance. One was that cells know where to put each of their synapses and it's somehow coded someplace in some blueprint or at least some rule saying, go there. This cell needs to connect to that cell. Imagine big microphone system saying cell 2629222, send connection 44449 to synapse 26949 on cell 2158. The alternative was cells are just randomly sending out projections everywhere, and there's no rhyme or reason to anything. And we're just somehow selecting from this total chaos a circuit that can speak and read and walk and do calculus and all those other things. And that seemed a little bit hard to believe as well. So what we're left with, I hope you see this image, is something somewhere in between. You certainly see a lot of stochastic, dynamic, active, chaotic, whatever you want to call it, searching kinds of behaviors. You see it even searching great distances down even this Pliocene. Maybe this Pliocene is just a thin layer. Right? I lost the trail of the rabbit and made it a stream. Maybe the dog jumps a stream and sees, is it, I don't see that. I'll go back across the stream. So this doesn't look like an impenetrable barrier. It just is an area that is less favored compared to this environment. What it was about this little ball of yuck that made this thing want to come over here, I don't know. Maybe there's cells alive in there, maybe there's not. But in the end, the result is a very clear turn. In the case of cell culture, what you can see is you're actually able to shorten the path when you come down here, and then you turn. What you'll see is you can actually sort of shorten all the stuff up by having this tissue or this axon slide over a little bit. See that? That can't happen in normal tissue. Right? It's like running a string through the forest. You can't just go, oh, now I'd rather shorten it. Now I see I've gone and winded my way all the way around there and up there. If I've left a path, I have to keep that path forever. So just to be clear, you'll see lots of things in cell culture that cannot happen in real neural tissue because there's too many other things going on. So all of the pathway that the axon took must be preserved, we'll see some slides on this, in the pattern of connection. So every error, every mistake you've ever made is actually visible in the final connection. You don't go back and, oh, now I see I'm going to go over here. I'll wind everything back out and then go over here. That's not typically how it's done. So that allows us to look and actually quantify how precisely neurons make it from point A to point B. And the short answer is at the gross scale, they are very precise. They almost unerringly, make it from motor cortex to spinal cord or visual cortex to superior cortex or wherever else they want to go. It's not a sensory cortex on one side, it's not a sensory cortex on the other side. Wherever they need to be going, they do it very accurately. But on the micro scale, the fine scale, the final little decision about should I sit up to that one or this one just seems totally chaotic and random as far as you can tell. Okay? Any questions about this? This is really our first example of this selective binding or differential adhesion that we talked about in the early embryo, where by having this thing better one type than another type, that can aid in selection of direct final location. Right. Now we ended last time talking about how we're going to move into the actual central nervous system, we're going to talk about real tissue, even in a system that we really care about, the visual system. Humans are quite proud of their visual system. We've learned a lot in neuroscience about how it's built. People Weasel won the Nobel Prize for figuring out how you balance inputs, and we're going to spend some time talking about exactly those experiments and what they tell us about development in general and neurons in particular. We're not going to worry about, again, all the individual details of the anatomy and the names, and we're not going to do trick questions, ask you to memorize the names of the structures. But do you need to know the basic anatomy and visual system? Absolutely. Do you need to know where you're coming from and to? Absolutely. Here we see what the book is forced to do, since it doesn't have a laptop and a projector, can't show you movies. And even in journals, we have a great deal of trouble recently really getting across processes that change in time. Now we have supplemental images and movies and things. But what we used to do is we just take a picture every certain point in time, in minutes, I believe, and it'll give you a feeling for how much the dynamics were in living tissue. Even though when I'm sitting here, it's all static. What we're looking at here is just one of these steps. The first one, it's one of the best studied. And the reason it's the best studied is not because it's the most relevant, most interesting, or most anything, but simply because it's easiest to follow. There's an easy prediction about what cells should do. The ones that are from the temporal retina should go to the ipsilateral side, and the ones that are from the nasal retina should cross. And the reason for that is very simple. You will remember, hopefully, that the brain does everything backwards. Whatever's on the left side of the world has to go to the right side of the body. So that's easy to do with the sense of touch. All neurons from this side just cross. Everyone here across has heard about decussation in anatomy. In the visual system, it's more complicated because one eye has information from both the left and the right side of the world. So what you want to do is have half of the information cross over and half not cross over. So this is helpful for us experimentally. We now know if I've got any given cell, I know what it's supposed to do here. What you might think happens is everybody just lock arms, they all go forward, and they just all split somehow. But what happens in reality is, in the optic nerve, all these fibers are completely tumbled out. You might think that they had some different environment on the top side of this versus the bottom side, and that sent them different directions. You might think they had a little wedge that divided them in a simple way, but they do not. They are both neurons from the top and the bottom of this retina, or nasal and temporal side of this retina. They're both experiencing exactly the same environment, and yet what they do with that environment is quite different. They're all mixed up, but they have very different responses. That means it can't be here a cell interaction that's actually telling the neurons which way to go, because all of the interactions are the same. The cells that provide the signal are identical to all these cells. So it must be the cell lineage that's actually determining whether or not a given cell makes a left turn or a right turn. So here we're looking at cells from two different locations, the nasal and temporal sides of the retina, doing different things. Here's a cell that progresses in many minutes towards this midline and then crosses it. And here's one that does an interesting thing. It comes there and it does just what we saw in that last picture. It sort of spreads out, it gets really big, it looks like it's, well, what's going on here? I'm trying to sense these different environments. I'm trying to compare that versus that. I'm not just touching it and going, oh, over here. I'm spending some amount of time trying to figure out what to do. And even when it finally decides to make this right turn, it leaves behind for a time, it eventually retracts them, some collateral processes that are going to continue to be exploring the other option, the road less traveled, so to speak. Any questions about that? Now, we do our standard story, we try to see, well, what genes are expressed here. Clearly, the two things you want to know is what possible different signals could there be? What genes are expressed differently in these cells than in these cells? And you might guess there aren't going to be that many, right? And they're both the same cells. They're both retinal ganglion cells. They should be expressing the same thing. The only difference is here and here, their location. And there's all kinds of cool techniques we talked about where you can grind up the mRNA from this and this, make the complementary strand of one, mix them together, do subtractive hybridization to specifically pull out, without any guesses, specifically pull out what proteins are going to be more expressed here versus here. And people have done that. And sure enough, they found a bunch of different proteins that are expressed differentially here and there. The other thing we can do is we can try to sort out what of the proteins in this area are contributing to this decision to turn left or right. Now, this is a little bit harder because there's obviously lots and lots of proteins here, and you have nothing to subtract it from. These cells just enter this environment, there's 10,000 proteins maybe, and you have no way of knowing which one is the critical one. But by starting off with what's different about these cells, you know what receptors, you're obviously looking for receptors, so looking for receptors, if these guys express, if these guys don't, or vice versa, you can get some guesses. You can then check to see whether or not what those two guys are differentially smelling is actually expressed at this point. If it is, you can then test, can I eliminate that molecule that these guys might be differentially sensitive to? Can I eliminate it from here and affect this stage of development? And the answer is yes, you can. So here's just one example of one type of protein. Again, there are probably more than one. This glycoprotein CD44, if it's not expressed, the optic chiasm doesn't form. Now, it isn't because the cells all go to the left or all go to the right. There isn't something nice like that. It's even simpler. Before we even get to the chiasm, the midline where you split, there's apparently another stage that we didn't even know about. Another stage that says, it seems like you're just growing along, you're fine, and there's one thing happening where some cells turn. But there's actually another stage happening here. And the only way we know this other stage is occurring is because we do some mutations. Suddenly we see a form of abnormal development that can only be explained by there must have been some decision right here that went wrong. Right? So this protein is involved in helping this decision, but only in the simplest way. It's involved in making sure that the cells actually come and finish their journey. It's apparently not necessary to have them come down the optic nerves, but it's necessary for them to come into the optic chiasm. And then there's always some other protein is involved in specifying which way they turn, maybe more than one, or many, many more than one. Any questions about this stage of development? Here we see some of the kinds of experiments that we're going to be doing. We know that cells from a given region of the eye are trying to get to the left or the right optic tectum. That's a simple branch point decision left or right. But we know a lot more than that. In addition to dividing where you're supposed to go based on left and right, individual cells need to go someplace so that you have an organized representation of the visual world. So this is the retina, and I want the retina to eventually have a map in the brain. I mentioned that the map of the brain is only going to be a half of this thing, so half of these guys will be represented on the other side. But the key thing is, this area has got to be mapped faithfully on some other brain structure. And in addition to getting all these guys to go to this side and not the other side, you also would like cells in region A to all go to a nearby place in A prime, and cells in region B to all go to someplace B prime, and cells in region C to all go someplace nearby in location C. So it's not just left or right into the basic right side of the brain. That's an important step, but it's just one of many steps. The more important one is to maintain the topographic order. And the reason is there's a map of organized location in space, and we want to have an organized map in our visual system so that we can tell where things are on that organized map of space. So what we can do then is we can predict that if I make an injection here of some molecule and I have it stain cells throughout their entire process, all the way to the entrance of their axon terminals, the prediction would be these guys will eventually go to some optic nerve and they'll all eventually end up here. So by staying here, I'll end up with a pattern of connections here. You can do the same thing the other way around. You can do an injection here and see which cells ended here and stain them back there. It goes both ways, doesn't matter. What the picture is showing you is how does the actual connections get to be here? And most importantly, it shows you all the errors that were made. It shows you how many times did this happen, where a cell from region A initially came from A and went to C and went, oh crap, I missed it, and then went over here and adjusted it. Okay? If that ever happened, you'd see it. So it may have the right pattern of connections, but you'd be able to tell that they made a big mistake coming along. And what we mostly see is diagrammed by a little picture is mostly you don't get big gross mistakes, but if you look carefully here, you'll see a few. So here's one of the things. These fibers were a little bit off the mark. They were in the right general direction, but they missed it by just a few hundred microns. They suddenly get to it and go, oh, that's where I really want to be, and make a drastic right turn. Okay? That's sort of amazing that they made it all this way, going nice and straight, following some other cue, and then they get up right to center and they make a drastic turn and get in that area. Here you can see a cell do the other thing. It missed it entirely. It went, oh crap, I think I missed it. I'm going to turn around, and went all the way back. It's shown schematically here. Okay. So there's many ways to look at this. One is, aha, look at biology and all the mistakes and screwing things up. But the other is to look at the vast majority of connections that didn't come from way over here or way over here. The majority of fibers that came into this particular area were from a discrete location, and they match. The final tuning is a little bit chaotic, a little bit random, but the gross anatomy suggests that very few fibers are coming in from way over here. Very few fibers made big looping mistakes. Mostly, everybody made a straight beeline shot right where they're supposed to go, a little bit of fine adjustments at the last moment, and then connections that are very highly topographic, so the inputs from region A are in fact connecting to region A prime. Any questions about this? All right. So far, everything is reasonable and fine. We're going to get to a slightly more complicated situation. Again, we're still talking about the visual system. We're still talking about trying to get the retina connected to the optic tectum, the first place it is connected to. Most of these experiments are done with frogs, but it doesn't really make any difference. A couple of things first to point out is the retina is not just a one-dimensional sheet like I've shown here. It's actually, of course, a two-dimensional sheet, and now we're looking on the back of the retina, and it's got a map, just like your digital camera, left and right, up and down, and you want to make a map in the optic tectum that has the same local topography. But it doesn't make any difference if the whole thing is upside down and inverted. That's totally irrelevant. And the answer is things in the visual system get upside down and inverted all the time, right? Information goes through your eye, and suddenly everything at the top of the world is going to be represented on the bottom of your retina, for example, right? Just because the lens is an inverting lens, and that doesn't confuse any of us. The same sort of thing is happening here. We go to the tectum, certain things are flipped, and certain things are not. And we're not so worried about the details. But what we're interested in is how do cells from a given region know to get where they're supposed to go? How do the cells on the opposite side know to go to the opposite side? And more importantly, how do each of the cells, in each of the stages in between, how do they know how to go systematically where they should be? Okay. So what we're going to imagine right off the bat is some sort of gradient, Q. Maybe there's a gradient that tells you from versus to ventral. It might be reversed, but it doesn't matter. And you're just trying to line up the gradients and match everything up. That's the kind of Q we've seen, where with one or a handful of molecules, you can specify what millions of different neurons do. That would be very advantageous.
Could it be that, and in addition to the gradient that you have on the tectum side, you would have a different upregulation or downregulation of the axonal receptors for that ligand on the other side?
Absolutely. So, and in fact, what we're going to see is sort of a matched combination of both of those. You're going to need to have two different things. You're going to need to have the cells coming in are going to need to be different. If they're not different, they're all going to be in the same place. And the places that they're going to need to be different also. So you're exactly right. Originally, we think we just need a signal and a receptor. That's it. But wait a minute. I want to create a whole family of outcomes, not just everybody with this trait come here. And so we're going to need a gradient here and a gradient here to get this done. Does that make sense, everybody? Now, we can then imagine that we're working at a gradient across here, a gradient across here. You can really hook it all up in a global positioning system that allowed you to have every cell here be unique and every cell here be unique, and it all just work. Now, it's a little bit hard to believe that because we've seen that the gradients kind of work best when you just got to break into four or five groups. Right? All we've ever done with a gradient really is this French flag business, like the dorsal ventral pathway, where we just want to say, do you or don't you turn on group over twist or snail or whatever else it is. But now we want to actually generate an analog position. We're not doing the French flag model anymore. We're trying to do analog. So it's cool to be able to make a band or an arm or an antenna or whatever, a torso. Now we want to actually create order of millions of neurons. It's going to be a little bit more challenging to think about. And we want to imagine this idea. Every time we can imagine a situation with a gradient, it's always good to imagine what would the other way be, because biology rarely follows the one way we can think of. There's at least other opportunities. One other option is literally everybody is just staying organized because there's already a map. Okay, you've already got a map and direction. If everybody just held hands and all marched forward, we'd all end up in the same place together. So the question is there any maintained topography in here? If you have a ribbon cable, a whole bunch of things coming out of the back of the old computers, you know, you can twist it and turn it and flip it upside down, it doesn't matter, but everybody's local pattern of connections is still in the same order, because you just maintain the same topography you already had, you never lost it. So an interesting experiment was done to test this possibility. And the two possibilities are these, and I'll be very clear what they are. One is, this cell knows where in the tectum it needs to be. So that cell there has a unique cell lineage, and it knows its position and it knows where it needs to go. The other possibility is any cell who happened to be there would end up connected down here. Okay, it's just a slide, you just slide down there, and these guys slide up there, and that's sort of all it is. There's just some mechanical reason that you end up where you end up. It is not because the cell actually knows. Now, there's a lot of ways you could test this. Our standard way to do this is transplantation experiments, right? You rip things out and shove them someplace else. If you start ripping individual cells out of a retina, it turns out retina is not nearly as happy being ripped apart as a young embryo is, and bad things happen, the retina kind of dies, and it's scar tissue, you're a mess. So it's not actually possible to rip out this cell and stick it up there. But an even better experiment is actually not only possible, but easy. And that is, rather than moving individual cells around, moving the clumps of cells, what if we could move all these cells up there and all those cells down here? Now that seems a little bit crazy, but it's actually quite easy to do. If you just grab the eyeball and rotate it around, then everything will be upside down. You'll have all the dorsal cells at the top and all the ventral cells at the bottom, and everything will be upside down. That would be a new position for the cells. The question would be, if I flip the world, will they now connect to some new place? Now, doing this in a young frog is kind of a challenge. They're actually going to do it in an adult frog, because adult frogs are unusual, and then if you cut their optic nerve, they grow a new one. You do not. You don't have that ability. Frogs do. So it's nice to be a frog if someone happens to cut your optic nerve. Not so nice to be a frog if you get stuck with a skewer. But the experiment allows us to study development without all the messy part of development. It allows us to recapitulate development and assume that the same properties that got this thing here to begin with are going to be reactivated. It's a pretty big assumption, but it turns out mostly to be true. In systems that regenerate, they really just rerun the same rules that they used in development. Okay, they have to still have those cues available. And that's one reason why we don't do it, because we're more complicated, apparently. And so we don't want to keep that capability all the time. We want to reuse the cues for new things. And now means regeneration doesn't work so well, because the cues you needed are now gone, because we use them for something else. So the experiment that was done was to cut this thing, also cut all the connections to all the eye muscles, rotate the eye around, and reattach it. So the eye would be perfectly fine, it happens to be upside down. Okay? And there's two possible outcomes of this. One possible outcome is that what the frog will do is the cells for the dorsal side that are now in the ventral, if they still know where to go, the cell that's now here will now connect to there. And the cell that's moved up to here will connect to there. If the cells still go to the right place, you'd think, great, what a very clever frog. Even though the eye is upside down, it all still connects to the right place. Now the problem is the frog will be very confused, because he's going to assume that information in one location means up and one location means down, and he'll now be confused. Because frogs are incredibly stupid, they never figure this out. So here's the experiment. They're going to cut the eye, rotate it around, and wait for it to grow back in, and test the hypothesis. How does it regrow? And the answer is, there is a cell lineage-based model. The cells do know where they're going. They're able to read these environmental cues. The environmental cues are different in each place. Got the texture, we haven't changed. So there's a cell lineage-based thing, the cells know where to go, and there's a cell interaction-based, that there are different environmental locations out here. And the consequence is shown here. Here's the lens with the world upside down. And again, when you go to the detector, it flips the world upside down again. And everything is fine. When someone goes and rips out your eye and replops it in place, but puts the eye upside down, now this switchover doesn't happen. And now the frog demonstrates that he actually re-hooked things up correctly. And it didn't require the eye to be in the right place. So if you just cut the eye, let it grow back, the frog shoots his tongue in the normal place and recovers vision perfectly normal. But if you rotate the eye upside down, the frog now forever sees a fly up here and shoots his tongue into the dirt, or sees a slug down here and shoots his tongue up into the sky. Okay? The point is not how can we mess up frogs, right? This whole class has been screwing up embryos, screwing up animals. It looked like, what are these goofy scientists doing? The point is there's a specific hypothesis we're trying to test. We're designing an experiment that's got two clear-cut answers that allow us to distinguish two possibilities. In some cases, we've got very particular hypotheses about very particular molecules. But in the early experiments, we don't. We just need something to very broadly parse out what's going on. Once you've got it parsed out, that causes you to choose from a more limited subset of possible mechanisms, and eventually you narrow down the actual biological mechanism, okay? This same process is going to be helpful to you, whether you're a physician or running a multinational company or trying to do a little bit of parenting. Whatever it is that you're doing, you got to first try to figure out the gross issue by doing an experiment, figuring out what's going on, then pare it down and become more and more refined. So rather than just memorizing these answers, memorizing these experiments, that's fine. The larger goal is for you guys to learn the scientific method, use these examples. If you're understanding biology broadly, I'll be able to ask questions on the test. How would you approach this problem? How would you tackle this? What would the kind of, how would you interpret this result? So that's the kind of skill I want, not just memorize all the experiments that have been done or memorize all the answers to all the steps. That's not terribly useful. Okay? Any questions about this so far? Alright. What we're going to get to eventually, it's a very nice figure, it's one of my favorite figures in the Kandel and Schwartz book, only because it's a nice little artist's picture, and totally schematic, doesn't show any kind of real data, but it gives you a nice sense, it wastes lots of room doing it, but they're simply showing you that the way we believe axon guidance really works is it's a multi-step process. The reason it works so well is not because there's just one clear cue. When you watch cells, you see them grow this way, and they turn that way, and they grow that way, and they do this, and it looks like they're following different cues in different places. And the molecular biology is really answering the story for us that that's right. We had at least four different types, positive or negative, in contact or chemo, and we see examples of all those being used. We can break someone down further. But here's one that's following some extracellular matrix protein that then binds some surface protein that likes to bind, then it binds some other surface. Again, all three of these are contact attraction. Just each one is slightly happier to stick to, so it first grows best on that stuff, and it grows best on this stuff. And once it finds a neuron, neurons like to stick to other neurons. That's why you get nerves. Suddenly it's like, oh, there's a nerve. I guess I'll follow that guy. We can get over here, and you can have chemo attraction. You'll say, ooh, I like being stuck to a nerve. That smells really good. It may break off its own branch. It may keep growing. It may suddenly reverse. Otherwise, it would stay stuck here. It may bounce off of this because it's contact inhibition, and that may cause it to bounce off some other thing that's chemo repulsive, and that may cause it to get to its right spot. Okay. Again, this seems unnecessarily complicated. Why is this way? Why are there 10 different steps to accomplish some goal? If I were to build it, I would have done it differently. It makes no difference how you would have built it, how we would have built it. This is the only thing that could have possibly evolved. It couldn't possibly have evolved any other way, because we need all this complexity. If there were one way that every gene went to where it was, if there were a blueprint, right? We talked about blueprint. If it really was written down, some special mechanism with a unique address, let's just imagine it being like the IP addresses in the internet. If you had fixed IP addresses where everybody knew where to go, and data got sent in little packets where it was supposed to go, that'd be great. It'd be very precise and beautiful, and even simple, economical. But it'd be very hard to have that adapt with the principles that we have running in natural selection to tweak each of those things separately, right? Evolution is going to slightly tweak this gene so it's not there, so it's stronger. So the receptor of that gene is not there, or stronger, or weaker, or whatever. And each of those tweaks, not just in whether it's there, but when each of those receptors and signals are present, will cause subtle changes in the organization of the circuit, whether you get to here or some other area. Those subtle circuit changes will cause subtle changes in behavior. And those subtle changes in behavior, if they're disadvantageous, will be selected against. If they're advantageous, will be selected for and passed down through generations. So again, just like we saw in the DNA, RNA, protein steps, the fact that there's 10 steps is not a problem. It's an advantage. It's more ways of regulating, more precision, more fineness, more ways you can keep most of what you want, but make some subtle tweaks. Because you don't want to randomly screw this up. If you've gone to the trouble to make the brain mostly right, you want to be doing minor tweaks. Evolution works best in small steps most of the time. And these kind of rules for guiding the mechanism getting you from point A to point B are very minimal to that process. Any questions about this idea? So here's what the world looks like from the point of view of the growth cone. Growth cones are much wider than the axons that they're trailing behind them. And they're expressing a whole variety of different receptors on their surface. Those receptors have the potential to bind to physical things that they're touching. These are the contact attraction schematics. This is how we thought everything worked at first. This is only one of the four possible ways, but it's an important one. The same growth cone can be expressed in receptors that allow it to bind to extracellular matrix proteins like lamin. They can allow you to bind to other neurons, including cell adhesion molecule, cadherin. And here's the ability to bind to glial cells. Remember, there's way more glial cells than our neurons, 10 to 1. And so being able to bind to the right kind of glial cells also very important, central and the peripheral nervous system. Now, this kind of looks like it's all locked down. This doesn't really look like it's going to make much progress if I've got little padlocks right here. Another lock and key idea. Here's two keys. It seems awfully rigid. How am I going to keep climbing? How am I going to keep moving? And we want to have an appreciation that each of these things is not like this, bound and fixed. It's biochemistry. There's some binding rate, some rate of binding and unbinding. It's not just do I fit. That old lock and key thing is okay for about 15 minutes until you realize it doesn't do any good. What you want is differential binding, certain things that are slightly better than others. That's what got us notch and delta. Sorry, that's what got us the dorsal ventral leading to the differential lag model. And that's what's going to get this whole system to work. Because you're constantly coming undone, constantly breaking apart. Nothing is reliable. None of these links are very strong. When structural engineers look and see what holds the body together, they go, oh my God, who built this thing out of like chewing gum and twigs? Like this is just never would work. But the reality is it's more important to have the flexibility than to have that great structural integrity. And so what we see is all these bonds are going to be broken all the time. as we saw those growth cones growing, these bonds have been formed and broken over and over and over and over. Now we can actually do experiments to test which kinds of molecules are helping cells bind together. You can do it with neurons or any other type of tissue. We have a bunch of neurons that express cell adhesion molecule, and any cell expressing cell adhesion molecule, you have a bunch of them together, they don't just tend to stick together. And you say, well, maybe they stick together for some strange reason, but you can go and block the action of cell adhesion molecules specifically without interfering with any other molecule in the cell, and you can specifically prevent this aggregation of the cells. So again, here's a simple technique using an antibody to be able to tease apart which particular molecules are involved. You have to test lots of things. What you find out, surprisingly, is they break up into a handful of families, 35,000 proteins seems like a lot, but the vast majority of them are one of a couple of different, maybe 100 different families, each one of which has got a pretty simple function. So you don't actually have to know 35,000 different things, you need to know a few hundred different things. So here's a bunch of different proteins from the immunoglobulin superfamily. We know that it's important for the immune system to recognize different types of cells. Most of you are trying to find out, is that a strep or flu or amoeba or whatever else it is inside your body you don't want there. The nervous system went used exactly the same idea. It's not clear who did it at first. Probably they happened together. But maybe the immune system came first. The nervous system stole these ideas. But once you've got a bunch of these binding proteins that allow for things like homophilic binding or heterophilic binding, you can put them to good use in the nervous system. So this gets us back to, all right, we've got a bunch of candidate molecules now for how these proteins are getting set up. How would it actually work that we could use molecules like these, this being selectively attracted to certain molecules, depending on what you're expressing? You could imagine that the way you hooked up the gradient from nasal temporal, connecting to the spheroclipid sort of protective, doesn't matter what you call it, nasal temporal to posterior to anterior, you could imagine, once again, it would be all about contact mechanism. And people did all kinds of experiments where they rotated, transplanted. All was difficult to distinguish between which of these four possible mechanisms was really involved. One was areas go to the area that they stick best to. The other is they go to the area that they're repelled from least. The other is they go to the area that smells best. Or the other is they go to the area that smells least bad. So all these are four possibilities. And we need an experiment, test them. Just watching the neurons grow, we'll tell you, in all cases, neurons go where they're supposed to go. So we've seen this before. Watching development does not tell us how it works. We have to intervene. And you'll find the same thing with patients and parenting and running a business. You've got to try things to figure out what works and what doesn't work. So here's a very beautiful experiment that was done historically to test this idea about what are the cues involved in these different places. And what they first had to do was simplify the system, there's too much going on in all this living tissue. What they did was they found out that you could just take cells, the tissue from the optic tectum, and grind it all up and purify out just the membranes. And no cells in there at all. And cells will still be selective from the retina to one type or another of tissue from one end to the other. Okay. And what you see here is, not too terribly surprising, here's a bunch of cells in the posterior area, and they're selectively choosing to go to the anterior side of the tectum, which is what they normally do. And so the historical thing we would think of was, oh, okay, there's something positive about this. It's causing these cells to go. To make a very long story short, what people expected was that the anterior end, these cells, would do the same thing the other way around, right? They would prefer the opposite. They prefer the posterior side here and not go to the anterior. And we didn't see that. After a long, laborious debate, eventually it became clear that what's really happening is just that the posterior membranes in the optic tectum smell bad. But they only smell bad to cells from the posterior end of the retina. So these cells don't go here, and that's it. We sort of thought there'd be kind of two different cues, one for anterior, one for posterior, but it turns out you don't need that. If you just have one cue and everybody else fill in the rest, you can actually get a lot done. Now the more amazing thing is we're trying to fill in not just A versus P, not just two locations, but thousands of locations across a continuum. And what we're going to do is we're going to combine all of the different mechanisms we've been discussing up until now, all in one beautiful mechanism, to help us organize the simplest kind of anatomy, where all you want to do is preserve this topography. Cells that are nearby should end up in nearby areas, cells that are nearby here should end up in nearby areas here. And the current understanding is cells in the posterior end are expressing a molecule that is chemorepellent. It smells bad. Cells in the posterior side of the retina express the receptor at a very high level, meaning they won't go anywhere near it. If there's any amount of it, they'll smell it and stay away. Cells, as you move across the tectum, express higher and higher amounts of the smelly stuff. As you move this direction along the retina, you express lower and lower amounts of the receptor. Everybody's got to go find a place. They're all being driven, all the cells, to find a target. And what you eventually come to understand is the anterior sites can't go anywhere. That's what you're seeing here. The reason they can go anywhere is because they don't express the receptor that tells them it smells bad anyway, so they're able to live wherever they want. Now this is confusing at first, because you think, well then why don't the anterior sections end up everywhere? Why is it that the anterior ends up specifically in the posterior? And it's because in addition to using molecular cues, you also use spatial cues. This spatial cue is actually going to be turned into a temporal cue. Cells from this side of the retina arrive a little bit earlier on this side, and they begin, like a land rush in Oklahoma or anyplace else, taking the nearest spot that seems suitable, leaving the rest of the tectum available. These guys can only live here. The next group arrives, and they can smell a little bit less, but they can still smell the bad smell over here, so they fill in a nice little stripe here. They don't keep going, they don't think it smells bad, they fill in what's available. The next cells are more tolerant to the bad smell, and can then become a stripe up in here. And the final cells to arrive, again, it's important that they arrive late, they are not able to fill in here, there's already cells there, not able to fill in here, there's already cells, not able to fill in here, or here. The only place left is the stinkiest place of all, which these cells can't attack, and so they fill in nicely. So we've combined two mechanisms. One mechanism is differential effect of a gradient in the expression of retina. The other is a gradient in the expression of a signal. And finally, that wouldn't be sufficient, except that the cells don't arrive simultaneously in time. They arrive sequentially in time, which allows us all to get sorted out much better. Any questions about this? So there have been all kinds of cool transplantation experiments where they rip cells out and pop in other places to confirm this. Eventually, nailing down what the two molecules were, EPH and efferent respectively, as the key signaling molecules. These molecules are known to exist in concentrations. People then wanted to find where are the molecules for this chemo-repellent that's a diffusible agent, right? So those agents, although they're in gradients, they're actually expressed in gradients. So they're not diffusing at all. They're located in particular areas, cells along these target areas, just expressing higher and higher concentrations, but they're staying localized to the cell. They're not diffusing around. Eventually, people found another type of repellent, not this type of repellent, which is you have to touch it to be disturbed by it. Didn't really turn out in this model that it smelled bad from distance. It only smelled bad if you were actually touching it. So it's better to say these things were prickly, and these guys didn't find it being prickly. But there are molecules that can be smelled from a distance. The consequence, after think about 30 seconds, of spritzing on a molecule called semaphorin, you know, an old flag thing from Boy Scouts called semaphore. That's where this family of molecules came from. This particular molecule is called collapsin because you put a tiny amount of it on and you activate a bunch of intracellular signaling cascades that cause you to go from this rapid growth and like that dog sniffing around for rabbits to suddenly collapsing down to only the core of the axon left, and that eventually will retract. Although those molecules are much more stable and retract over much more time. So again, it's another cartoon from a review article just showing you the way it's currently envisioned. these cells might start going in the right direction because they're being repelled in a bigger direction, it's knowing. They stay in some channel because there's a happy place. They don't turn off because there's a prickly place on the other side. They come out and they make a turn because they're attracted to something and get to the location of entrance. What we've done now is a major accomplishment, took a long time, but it's easy to just take for granted now, is identifying what all these molecules are. And some were genetic approaches, some were writing about the biochemistry, some were testing things that seemed like likely candidates. And we may not have found all of them, but we certainly found enough that there aren't any major areas where we go, how could this possibly work? So with dozens or hundreds of different possible molecules involved, it seems like this is not as intractable a problem as it used to be. So for chemorepressants, we saw that the netrins, which we normally think of as chemoattractants, can also serve if you simply modify the sign of the action of the receptor. We saw those semaphorins typically serve as chemorepellents. We saw the EPH ligands and other forms of semaphorins can do contact repulsion. The extracellular matrix protein in some cases can be repellent to some areas and can be attractive to others. The immunoglycans, in particular cell adhesion molecules like NCAM and cadherin, can help with contact attraction. And again, netrin was the standard chemoattractor. Just to fill the chart in a little bit more, we go back to this initial idea that you're going to need contact and chemo versions of attraction and repulsion. Now breaking it down into you're going to need a signal and a receptor for each. This is a few years old now. I'm sure all these are now filled in. But it was a little bit of a thing to fill in. Oh, we know the signal, we know the receptor. And nowadays, whole human genome sequence, it's not a big deal to put together a story about how these processes actually work. What we want to think about is, how am I going to set up a particular circuit? And again, we don't have time to go through every gore detail, nor do we know for any given pattern of connections exactly all of the molecular biology involved. But one of the most important circuits that we learn from neuroanatomy is the basic wiring of the cerebral cortex. So you guys know the inputs come in from the periphery, they go through the thalamus. From the thalamus up the cortex, they send out to layer four cells connect up to layer two, three cells connect to other layer two, three cells in other cortical areas, but they also connect to layer five cells are the ones that send information back down to the subcortical structures, and also to layer six, and layer six sends a reciprocal connection back to the thalamus. So exactly what this particular circuit is good for, we still don't know. It gets used over and over and over, lots of it, and half your brain is built with this circuit. I'm not quite sure what it does, but you can be sure that there are built-in mechanisms in your genetic code that are gonna make this circuit be built for a moment. In conditions of abnormalities or mutations in any of the genes involved in this process, you can imagine this circuit either being completely screwed up or slightly screwed up. If it's completely screwed up, you'd imagine severe mental retardation would result. Evolution shapes the circuit for a very long period of time, and it's not going to tolerate major changes. It's just not going to work. If you're talking about a small change, there's 10% less of these neurons, or 10% fewer of them project where they're supposed to go, or they project half the time the right place and half the time the wrong place, you could have a whole gradation in terms of the severity of the neurodevelopmental disorder. One of the things that bothered people for the longest time was, this doesn't seem that hard. You have a module, you build something, and then you kind of copy it. And we see that evolution can solve hard problems by doing the same thing over and over in what look like different ways, but keep using the same tools. So we saw homing box genes and other things that allow that to happen. In the case of the cortex, cortex is cortex is cortex. Whether you're doing language with it, or vision with it, or touch with it, or anything else, it doesn't really matter. It's the same basic circuits. The only differences are where you get your inputs from, or the primary differences are, where you get your inputs from, and where you spend your outputs back to. And for the thalamus, you want to send your inputs back to the same place from which they came, and so maybe that's not such a hard problem. So this one was people focused on for a while as a really challenging problem. Different cells throughout the cerebral cortex have to send their information back to different subcortical structures, right? motor cortex has got to connect to spinal cord, visual cortex has got to connect to spherical lymphus, and so on and so forth down the line. And these targets are very, very far away. And again, to make a long story short, the way people determine this happens is quite surprising. What happens is there's basically one blueprint, one way of doing it, and then you refine back from there. So again, we always think, make the connection first, right the first time, but what we often find in neural development is make extra connections and then get rid of the ones you don't need. So we see this in the development of these layer 5 cells in the cerebral cortex. Here's a cell sending out a process and it going the long distance to put all the way to the spinal cord. Almost all of your cerebral cortex sends protections to the spinal cord, even if they're not necessary. You then get these spontaneously blooded off formation of collaterals that go to all the other subcortical sites you might want to go to if you're a cortical neuron. The cortical neurons know all the places to go, and they go to all of them. That seems a little bit inefficient, but remember, it doesn't take that much energy to do these things. It's more important to get the circuit set up right. Depending upon something about being the visual cortex as opposed to being in the motor cortex. And again, it could be a signal present in that area, or it could be the very patterns of activity themselves. The inputs that arise in motor cortex are different. They've got different correlation structures than in vision. What you see is a retraction of the connections that you don't need. In one case, visual doesn't need to be connected to the motor system, and the motor system does, but doesn't need to be connected to the visual system. Okay? Any questions about this? Now I just want to talk a bit about how we're going to actually make this machine run. And one of these questions is always, how much detail do we really want to know? How interesting is this problem? And I want to encourage you to really think about the growth cone, because it's one of the examples where you really see the kind, you see a single cell, interesting things happening. You're really building toward structures that you care about, having a motor system or a visual system. It's pretty rare to see that. So you can go from a single cell and imagine function kind of easily, because you can see we're creating neural net. In this single cell growing out, you can see the past lineage. And we've talked about how that lineage is going to be established based on cues that come from mom and gradients and French 5 models, all the rest. Different cells, even very nearby cells, can be different, including things like notch delta, where cells were identical before, but they picked different cell lineages. They became different types. We can see examples in this particular system of cell interactions, right? Whereby the environment that you get and how you bind the specific signals is going to determine what you're actually going to do, who you're actually going to have connected to. We can see that cell lineage is going to be turning on different genes, particular different receptors. And we can see these cell interactions are going to be resulting in different signals. Okay? This is one of the most sophisticated examples of all these pieces kind of coming together. And it's of interest, I think, to most people. It's very easy to imagine if this gets screwed up, you're obviously going to have broad mental retardation that's screwed up broadly, and you're going to have very specific deficits. If you've only screwed up the retraction of visual areas, you may be fine broadly, but you may have screwed up visual experiences, or screwed up motor experiences, or screwed up regulation of emotion, or whatever else it might be. Lastly, we're going to have this sort of motor component. Before, we've been talking about all these genes, and all they're going to do is turn on more genes. But we're actually going to be able to get down to, as we discuss this, looking at this thing actually moving in real place. And again, that's very important, because genes turning on genes, turning on genes, doesn't seem like it actually ever happens. And this is one of the examples where you actually, you know, you make something visible. So what I want to do for a moment is talk about how could this thing possibly work? How could there be a system where one cell is doing all this, and realize it's not really just one cell, it's really one fraction of one cell, right? You've got 10,000 different connections you have to make. The big distances are all made by one primary thing, but the final connections, all these same things are involved, different receptors, different signals, creating different data at the fine level. So it's actually individual synapses doing all this stuff and making 10,000 different connections. So what we talked about here were some of the molecules that were involved, but this seems like kind of a lifeless cartoon. It's hard to really imagine this doing anything. Okay, I can imagine this thing moves, I've seen it move. I can imagine that once you've got one guy connected, the other guys could just sort of piggyback on and go along for the ride. I can imagine that you can have receptors that will span the plasma membrane. And if I told you what the specific cytoskeletal structures in the middle were, it's like, okay, those cytoskeletal structures are there. So what? What we see when we look at these structures, these filopodia, these little spikes, and these lamellipodia, are composed of polymerized actin. So if you're staining, what you see when you collapse the molecule with that semaphorin collapsing, is that all this goes away and you're left with just this nub. So here we've got the neurofilaments that are very stable, and the exciting, growing, really moving dynamic in is all this actin. Now actin is the most exciting gene in the whole world, if only because it's the most common. If you were to add up all the proteins in the whole planet, you're going to get more actin than you get with anything else. So if you look at the similarity of actin across tiny pond scum all the way up to ourselves, you'll see it's basically the same gene. So it suggests there's something important about actin and how to think about its regulation. And in particular, how to think about its regulation in relation to axon guidance. So here's the brief story. What's happening as the cell grows out isn't impossible to understand. I think the book's image of it greatly simplifies and leaves you with kind of a half understanding that I don't actually think is quite sufficient. So we'll work through the book's explanation, we'll try to put a little bit more flesh on it. What the book is saying is there's just two processes. It isn't that hard to understand. To move this thing forward, we're not going to look at it cut from the side. All you're going to do is have endocytosis on one side and exocytosis on another. I got to move this thing forward, I got to put more membrane down. Well, that's something that presynaptic nerve terminals are really good at. So it shouldn't surprise us that this thing is able to have endocytosis and exocytosis. Of course that's true. The other piece they sort of throw out is this new notion, maybe to some people, called actin treadmill. And the notion here is, what we're going to do, in addition to regulating where we do endocytosis and where we do exocytosis, it's all about protein localization, getting proteins in just the right place. Not about the amount, but about where they're activated. Same thing here. If I depolymerize actin here, and I polymerize it here, I'll tend to grow this chain forward. That'll push me forward. If I make some new links here, I can then decouple these links, and that'll just keep pulling me forward. Okay? I'm going to argue that this kind of makes sense. You can see examples of it working well. Here's all the biochemistry relating the surface protein, extracellular matrix protein, laminin, the integrins that bind to it. There's a whole understood network of biochemistry linking these things together, but we're still left kind of back here. Like, okay, so there's all kinds of biochemistry, so there's all kinds of molecules. How do you actually steer this thing? So the big thing that I think the book misses is a really vivid understanding about how this thing does what you've seen it do. To know the names of a bunch of genes and be able to impress someone doesn't really help you, because if someone asks you, well, what makes it turn right? You'll say, well, some gene does. And that's the same answer you would have before you ever took this class. If someone asks you, how do you get this color hair, or this height, or this number of toes, you'll say, well, a gene does it. And that's not really very satisfying. And if someone has got the wrong number of toes, or the wrong hair color, or the wrong brain organization, you're going to say, well, I guess his genes are busted. And that, again, doesn't help. And if someone says, well, what specific intervention could I do? You'd say, well, I don't know. I don't really understand how it works. And it becomes very fatalistic. So just thinking about genes doesn't cover it. We really want to have a better mechanistic explanation. So let's go through talking about how this actin treadmilling would really work in the real world. So the idea of treadmilling is analogous to a tank. So I think everybody understands how a tank works. There's little wheels. It keeps laying down its own road. It lays down its road on one end and picks up its road on the other end. Because the tank treads basically stick in the mud, the thing rolls forward. Okay, so this is not that hard to understand. So let's look down on one of these growth cones. It's growing out from the bottom.
And the way we're going to imagine it is, there's a bunch of tank treads here. And if all we do is assemble actin here, polymerize here, and depolymerize on this end, this thing's going to tend to roll forward. Everybody understand that concept? So now we want to try to learn how to steer this thing. Now we've got a machine that we can roll forward. Kind of complicated, because we have to be able to do different things just a few micrometers apart. Right? This seems easy, like just assemble it there and reassemble it there. That doesn't, how hard could that be? Well, you try it. Right? On this scale, it's very difficult. We don't have anything like this in the nanomaterials, the nano, all the rest people talk about. It's very difficult to figure out how you would actually get this to work. And biology solved it a billion years ago. So there are mechanisms whereby you can depolymerize here and repolymerize there. You're also, for what it's worth, going to be taking in pieces of the membrane and depositing them up there so that you can grow. But we want to specifically think about steering this thing. Okay? And the job is to make this thing forward, but to have different cues. So slightly more of something over here is going to cause it to go in one direction. Right? So let's imagine that our tank is rolling forward. And it suddenly hits a patch of ice. So who can guess what happens when a tank rolling forward suddenly hits some oil or a slick spot? Anybody? Okay, it starts to spin. If it runs into a bunch of oil that's like this, it's just going to spin and stop there, not go anywhere. But if it runs into a bunch of oil, it's more like this, where it's only hitting one of the two treads. Now what happens? It's going to turn. Now which direction is it going to turn? Right or left?
Right.
Okay. So if you hit a slick spot, you actually turn to the right. Because the left side is going to be more powerful, it's going to be driving and turning this way. Now this is very counterintuitive, right? Because we've talked about if you find something that you stick better to, so instead of this being slick, let's say this is something you stick well to, some good tread, good traction. You find a place you really stick well to, what is the consequence going to be there? Turn right or turn left?
Left.
Okay, so you're going to turn left here, because you're getting not quite as good here. There's a little bit loose gravel here, and you suddenly hit a nice firm patch of stone. This thing is slipping a little bit, and you're going to turn the opposite direction of the way you really want to be going. Okay? And you can imagine this happening in all the dimensions, and it gets very confusing pretty quickly how this thing actually runs anywhere at all. Now we know that the growth cone is able to handle this. Even more than that, it's able to take in chemoattractants. There's some molecule out here, molecule A, let's say it's natron, and it's existing in some gradient. And the concentration is slightly higher here compared to here, right? This source may be many, many millimeters away. And so the difference in the concentration, this thing's only a fraction of a millimeter wide, is not going to be very much. And yet we see this thing suddenly turn in that direction. And to make a long story short, the solution to this is that the tracks don't look anything like this. The treadmilling idea, the picture that the book shows, it works great in one dimension. It allows you to go fast or go slow. You're going to go faster on good traction and slower on slow traction. But it won't let you turn. And turning is all you really want to know. Right? Going fast or slow, that's sort of boring. You really want to be able to go up and over and around the hills. The real story doesn't look anything like this. The way it really looks is like this. Okay? And in all these cases, you're depolymerizing and polymerizing. Now this is really very different. You're now having to have one zone here that does one thing and a zone out here that does another thing. And you've got a tractor that's ripping itself apart. Not the kind of thing we would build right off the bat. Whether you're going to the moon or anyplace else, you're not generally going to build something that pulls in opposite directions. The way this machine works is to pull in opposite directions. Now why would you want to build a machine that pulls in opposite directions? What are the advantages of a machine that pulls in opposite directions? Anyway.
So you can control it in different directions and then decide where you
want to
go.
Exactly. The key thing is this creates competition. It seems inefficient. You're wasting energy pulling yourself apart. But by its very nature, it's very unstable. You can go either way. It doesn't matter where. It's like sitting on a nice edge, this device. It's a very strange car to drive. It can immediately go any other way it wants to go. Right? Your car never works to the left. It just can't do that. If you had wheels that could spin all around, it could. So this system is constantly weighing all possible options. When you watch it being driven, you see that it went over here, over there, up and down, left, right. The pictures we saw were only two dimensions. Imagine this in three dimensions. Shooting spikes to the roof, shooting spikes to the floor, out in all directions. Each one is testing the environment. So that if it finds a place that it gets an attraction, it doesn't turn away from it, it pulls toward it. If it finds a place over here that's slick, then these things get no traction, that's going to cause it to go down. So in this kind of model, you turn towards things you can stick to and away from things you can't.
So for chemo attractions, does it work where it has like just an initial, this side has more than this side, or is it, well, I can feel it on both sides, but if I go this way, it's getting less, if I go this way, it's getting more.
Both of those things happen, if I understand. So the two things that you got to add in, one is, if this signal is coming from here, it's more concentrated there. You're going to be slightly more effective at polymerizing these things. There's some receptor here for that and here. I'm going to be directly comparing. They're both getting metric. But this one's getting slightly more. And because of the finite pool of action, every extra molecule you polymerize here, you're stealing it from here. So that causes you to pull this direction. But that's now. In addition, what you see is that a neuron, like the dog, has to have a memory of, was it better when I was over there or over here? We don't really have much of an understanding about that. But the behavior of these cells strongly indicates that, like a dog, they'll sniff here, go, okay, hold that thought, I'll come over here, sniff over here, and I'm going to remember now. And that's much more complicated than just telling two things apart simultaneously. But biochemical mechanisms also have these sorts of memories that allow you to go back and say, no, I think that one was better. Though that kind we don't understand well, this kind we're beginning to understand, and it really suggests that you should think about the growth count because it relates to so many things you care about and brings so many topics to bear in an area that actually moves and does things. Okay, that's it.